abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Thursday, January 16th, 2014. Talking to John Payne today about the drug war and the militarization of the police. I shuffled a guest around this week. I had Brad Berzer on. This is a little different from what I told you we were going to have happen on Monday. I had Brad Berzer on Tuesday, and we had to push Jacob Hornberger to next week because of a scheduling conflict. So next week we're going to have Jacob Hornberger, the great Scott Horton, Walter Williams, and more. I also want to welcome back Robert Murphy to the program. I want to get Bob to come on here and talk to us about what's going on in the economics profession. We've got so many economists of great renown who are coming out in favor of an increase in the minimum wage. I want to get to the bottom of that. Bob's been blogging about that, and he's our best guy to talk to. And remember, you got to make sure and like my page on Facebook, because I've been soliciting questions on Facebook for some of the guests. And the thing is, my Facebook page is Thomas E. Woods Jr. It's very annoying, but that's how it was started, and there's no way to fix it. Somebody else started it for me, and I do appreciate that. My Tom Woods page on Facebook is my personal page, and I'm already at the friend limit. So make sure and like my Facebook page at facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods, or just click on like on the Facebook widget at tomwoodsradio.com, because I want to get some questions from you guys for Bob Murphy. I want to get some questions, preferably ones we haven't covered in the past, but anything that you don't understand about economics that's just confusing to you, or that involves people using terminology that they just assume everybody knows, but maybe you don't know. And if it's a question that I can fit into the program and that seems to be of general interest, I'll try and ask Bob. So I'm going to have a thread sometime, probably next week. I'm going to open it up and say, what should I ask Bob? So we'll talk to him about that minimum wage thing, and then I want to open it up to him for your questions. So facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods. And if you're on Twitter and not on Facebook, you can tweet questions for Bob Murphy using #AskMurphy. I am Thomas E. Woods on Twitter. We are past the halfway point here in January, so you've got only 50% of the time left to get your free signed copy of my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, which you get when you join my LibertyClassroom.com this month only, January 2014. So on February 1st, don't even think about sending me a note saying, oh, but Woods, I never got around to it. At that point, I'm going to deny I even had this giveaway. I don't know what you're talking about, you raving lunatic. So January 2014 is the time to do it. Sign up at LibertyClassroom.com and then drop me a note on the contact page with your mailing address, and we'll ship that baby right out to you. Just browse around at LibertyClassroom.com, look at the courses, see what we have to offer. These are all offered at your convenience. You get every single course we have when you join. Kevin Gutzman on his Facebook page has been talking about the lessons that he's been preparing for the course on the American Revolution that's coming up, which looks absolutely fantastic. I've got a course coming later in the year that's going to take a typical economics textbook and go through chapter by chapter and dissect the fallacies. I mean, fantastic. I mean, my gosh, this is going to be great. All right, anyway, right now we're talking to John Payne, our old friend John Payne, who is executive director and treasurer of Show Me Cannabis, which is an organization dedicated to overturning the current prohibition on marijuana. So let's talk to John Payne right now. John, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Now, what caught my eye was this piece you wrote for the American Conservative magazine not too long ago. It was actually a book review, but you were talking about the militarization of the police, which is a topic that we've covered a number of times on this program. There's a lot of interest in that subject. Maybe you can give us a little bit of an overview of this, because implicitly your take on this had a lot to do anyway with the drug war, because the book you're talking about had to do with the militarization of the police, but you were connecting the dots the way the author did to note that this didn't just occur spontaneously. This isn't just sort of an oddball feature of American police that they happen to be militarized, but there seems like there's some connection between this and the war on drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. Radley Balko is the guy who wrote
That's
the book,
right.
And he's
That's right.
Yeah, he's been working on this for some time, and you know, he started out, I believe, at the Cato Institute, and now he's actually at the Washington Post. So he's actually a part of the mainstream media now, which is kind of exciting. But I've long thought that he's kind of the most important journalist working, because he's exposing all these atrocious, you know, police raids that are happening oftentimes to people that have done absolutely nothing wrong. They actually have the wrong house and they're busting in and terrorizing the occupants. And he's been documenting this for probably about a decade now. And in the book, he talks about that there are now about 50,000 SWAT raids in this country every year. And the way that we got here basically was that back in the 70s and then, you know, more in the 80s when Reagan ratcheted up the drug war, they started giving away military equipment to police departments. They started giving grants to enforce drug laws. And so all these, the more arrests you can show, the more money you can get from the federal government, specifically for drugs. You know, if you arrest more people for robbery, rape, murder, that doesn't register for federal grants. But if you arrest a lot of people for pot, then they will give you a big chunk of money. And that was through burn grants and also the cops grants. And so these sorts of things are what have driven departments to sort of focus on drug offenses and to enforce them in such a heavy-handed manner. And now I also do know that, you know, Radley doesn't talk about this as much in his book, but I know a police officer, a chief of police, actually, who is, very sympathetic to, he opposes police militarization as well, and he works sort of out in the St. Louis exurbs out in Lincoln County here in Missouri. And I've talked to him a fair amount about this, and he says that one thing that Radley is kind of missing, though, is that the culture of policing changed in the 70s and 80s. As well, they started hiring a lot of guys from coming out of the military after Vietnam, and this is a trend that just sort of kept up. And they didn't ever try to, enforce the idea that the military and policing are two very different things. Yeah. Because you know, if you go out there and you're in the military, your job is to blow things up, essentially. Whereas the job of a policeman is to keep the peace. You're not supposed to be provoking violence. You're supposed to be defusing it. And so it's a really different job, and a lot of people don't understand that, even people who work in that field. And so that's another problem that needs to be addressed.
But is a lot of this police militarization and a lot of these tactics, like the use of SWAT teams, et cetera, are these really being directed at pot users, or wouldn't this be directed at drug kingpins somewhere? I mean, I could imagine the average American maybe more and more thinking, well, you know, maybe marijuana isn't so harmful after all, or there's so many people who want to use it, there's no point in trying to lock them all up, but we got to go get those heroin dealers because heroin makes you drive crazy and go out and want to murder people. So in other words, I can imagine that there are some people who are moving a little bit closer to a libertarian view on marijuana, but maybe still are wary about the harder drugs. But are you saying that a lot of these tactics that make us uncomfortable that the police are using are not really discriminating between types of drugs? They're just as likely to go and bother somebody who's got, you know, two joints as they are somebody in heroin and harder drugs?
I don't know about two joints. They probably wouldn't execute a search warrant if that's all they thought a person had, but I will say that they get it wrong a lot. So it doesn't really matter sometimes what they're pursuing, because if they go to the wrong house, then it's going to be a bad situation.
Yeah.
One of the more famous examples was that in Atlanta, the police had been tipped off by a confidential informant that there was drugs being dealt out of this house in a pretty bad neighborhood, and they didn't do anything to check out the confidential informant statement. and they just raided the house. And the house turned out to belong to, I can't remember her exact age, but she was a very old woman, Catherine Johnston. And she didn't know what was going on, so she grabbed a little pistol that she had for self-defense, because she lives in a bad neighborhood. I mean, if you live in a place like that, it certainly makes sense to have a gun. And when the police started busting down her door, she fired. She didn't know it was the police. And then they responded with just an absolute hail of bullets. And when they figured out that, this is not the person, this is clearly, this lady is not selling drugs. What they did is they attempted to plant drugs and let her bleed to death on the floor. That is an extreme example, of course, but they've had a number of these wrongdoer raids. One of them in Columbia, Missouri, which is where the University of Missouri is located. I guess it wasn't a wrongdoer. They thought this guy had a larger amount of marijuana than he did. When they got in, he had less than two joints. He had a grinder with some marijuana residue in it, and that's all they found in the guy's house. And they busted down his door and shot his dogs. And that's a video that went kind of viral a few years back. It was on Judge Napolitano's show. A lot of people talked about it. That's the one where Charles Krauthammer said that, this is just sort of the collateral damage of the drug war. This doesn't happen that often. But the thing is that I've looked into that case in particular and into SWAT raids in Missouri pretty extensively. And it's not that that doesn't happen. It's that very few police departments actually record their police raids, like the Columbia Police Department was doing at the time. And so it's just very rare that we actually see that happen.
John, we're going to link in the show notes to your article from the American Conservative, How Police Became a Standing Army. I want to talk about a piece that you actually sent along to me just a few minutes ago. And the headline, this is from the News Leader. This is out of Springfield, Missouri. Concerns aired at council meeting about police-guard partnership. And it's a proposed agreement with the Missouri National Guard, between the Missouri National Guard and the police, to work together in waging the drug war. Now, tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a proposal that was just made last week, and they heard it at the council meeting on Monday, so last night. Now, the police chief is now saying that, it's just going to be a guy from the National Guard basically consulting with us on our drug raids and executing search warrants. But the thing is that the proposal includes, use of aerial surveillance, and it does say that the National Guard's people shouldn't be armed when they're helping the Springfield Police Department out. But nevertheless, if you give people the power to use military equipment and to use military surveillance to use for domestic law enforcement, we are now talking about having the military enforcing domestic law. And that is, in my review, I talk about how that's one of the main things that the colonists revolted against the British for, is that they were using the military to enforce domestic law and imposing them upon the civilian population. So it is not inaccurate to say that that is trending towards a police state. It may not be actually a police state just yet, but it's that would be where it's headed. And now I don't know that I think that they are. That's still likely to pass, I think, but I do think that because of the opposition that showed up, they are likely to strip out the part about the aerial surveillance because they say that they don't really need that. But if they don't need it, then I don't have it in the bill. So I think that's I'm hopeful that they'll at least take that part out. And also, they just really have no point to have. There is no need to have the National Guard come in and enforce these laws. We actually had an ordinance that we were supporting down there back in 2012 that would have decriminalized small amounts, possession of small amounts of marijuana. And that's the way the law works in St. Louis and Columbia. And they at the time, the city council said, we don't actually consider this to be a top priority as it is, so we don't really need to change the law around it. Well, if it's not a top priority, then why do you need the military to come in and help you enforce the law?
Now, I have to ask you, because of the, you know, the organization that you belong to and the work that you're doing, I just want to ask you some general questions on the just on the overall subject of marijuana, because I just remember being a kid in elementary school, and I remember the film strips they gave us about the dangers of marijuana, and, you know, you would die within 6 months, and the effects are so much worse than other things on you, and this and that. And now, look, I've never smoked it. I'm not interested in smoking it. I have no dog in this hunt one way or the other. But I'm somebody who just doesn't like being lied to. Like, I don't want to be told something is super dangerous when it's not. Because that leads to exactly what we've been talking about today. Ridiculous overreaction, tremendous civil liberties violations, all these problems stemming from the drug war. And the fact is, I really don't. I know I have no control over what the government does with the resources that it expropriates from me, but I just don't care. If people want to go use this stuff, it doesn't, I don't care. I, on the other hand, am concerned about burglaries in the city where I live. I'm concerned about crimes against person and property. But these crimes, there's a certain reason that the government seems to have an incentive to go and search out people who are drug users or drug dealers, and not to go after the burglary, the guys who broke into the house down my street, because there's no cash reward waiting for them at the end. There's no big pile of cash as there would be in a drug raid. So I guess what I want to ask you first of all is, what can you say to people who say, look, there are tremendous health risks associated with marijuana use? What's your answer to that when somebody says that to you?
My answer would be that, I mean, it depends on how you define tremendous. There are definitely a lot of health risks associated with marijuana. However, relative to a lot of other drugs, it is not that harmful. You know, the Lancet, which is sort of the British equivalent of the American Medical, or the Journal of American Medicine, put out a study a few years back trying to assess the relative harms of various drugs. And cannabis came in fairly low. I forget the exact number, but it scored that it was less harmful than, you know, cocaine, heroin. I think everyone would expect that, but also nicotine and alcohol. So, you know, this is not something that is tremendously dangerous, I don't think. It has its risks, certainly, but I also don't think that prohibition has actually done a whole lot to stop people from using it and to, you know, diminish any of those risks. In fact, if anything, it's probably made it more dangerous because you don't know exactly what you're getting. The quality isn't as assured. You know, on a open market, you can actually have some kind of idea of what you're buying, whereas on the black market, you're dealing with drug dealers who don't, you know, they are not obeying the law. They are a lot of times they're, you know, the ultimate product came from the Mexican cartels. That's not good. That's encouraging violence around the market. And it's basically the same thing that we had with alcohol prohibition when you had Al Capone in Chicago. Well, now we have the Sinaloa cartels, the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico. And in fact, it just came out that the DEA had been assisting the Sinaloa cartel in exchange for their cooperation, with one of their high-ranking capos, I guess, who was helping them take down other cartels. So that's the sort of, if you want to enforce these laws, you have to become morally compromised yourself, and that's basically what we're seeing in law enforcement. And yes, that's also why they're going after drug crimes more than they're going after other crimes, is because there's also a financial incentive under current law. As you pointed to, asset forfeiture allows the government to come in and say, okay, this property was associated with a crime, then therefore we can take that property and we can keep it. And specifically, the law enforcement agency that seizes it can keep it, at least under federal forfeiture statutes. As long as there is a federal agent associated with that investigation, then the federal government keeps 20%, and they can kick back up to 80% to the law enforcement agency, the agency that seizes it. And I think that's, going back to the Springfield thing, that's a clear That's clearly what is going on there. That's why they're interested in it, because the Missouri National Guard Counter-Drug Task Force actually put out a press release at the end of 2013 saying, hey, we seized $24 million in assets this last year. I'm quite certain that the city council member who introduced the measure down there saw that and said, hey, why can't the Springfield PD be getting some of that action? And so, yes, there's a financial incentive here. And when you start taking police work, police away from the work that we really want them to do, stopping violence and property crimes, and directing it towards nonviolent drug offenses, well, then I think you've actually made society substantially less safer for everyone. And so whether you use these substances or not, or whether you're ever interested in using them, that doesn't matter. What matters is that you're actually making society less safe by taking our scarce resources away from the people who really seek to do us, combating the people who really seek to do us harm.
Now, I could be wrong about this, John, but I'm pretty sure that in a lot of these asset forfeiture cases, they invert the traditional presumption of innocence, and you have to prove that, no, you weren't involved in growing or producing anything illegal on your property, and once you can prove that to their satisfaction, then maybe you can get it back. Have you heard about—am I wrong about that? I'm pretty sure I read this.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. So in federal forfeiture law, now it differs. States have different statutes on forfeiture, but the thing is that it almost always ends up going federal because they can do that as long as they have a federal agent associated with it, and if you're dealing with any sort of drug task force, they will. And the federal forfeiture statutes are the loosest, so they're the ones that most agencies will pursue. And under those statutes, you know, if you go to a trial for a criminal offense, they are trying a person, and a person has constitutional rights. Property, however, does not have constitutional rights. And so what they're literally doing is they are bringing charges against a piece of property. So there are cases out there that are United States federal government versus $20,000 in cash, United States government versus Cadillac Eldorado. And so when they get into court in those cases, they don't have to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt as they would against a person. They only have to prove their case with a preponderance of the evidence. And the burden is actually on the other, on you to get your property back, because they already have your property. So you have to go to court. You have to take them to court. If you don't do anything, they'll eventually just get to keep it. So you have to come in there and present evidence that you did not, that this property was not involved in a crime. And eventually they may, you know, if you can prove that to their satisfaction, then you get the property back. But that also requires hiring a lawyer. Well, I mean, you could potentially do it yourself, but you're probably not going to win that way. Mm. So you basically have to hire a lawyer. And now if they've taken, say, $300 from you, well, would it even be worth your time to go get a lawyer? Of course not. So there are a lot of cases out there where the police have essentially engaged in shakedowns, where people have just, you know, you'll see the ledger, it's just $50, $100, whatever cash this guy has on him as they're coming through a specific town. The worst example of this is probably Tenaha, Texas, a few years back, where it was literally basically like a speed trap, but instead of giving people speeding tickets, they were just taking whatever money they had on them through asset forfeiture statutes. And it was, at least on the face of it, totally legal. Eventually, when that pattern of behavior became evident, they did get sued, and they did have to return the money that they took from all these people. But, you know, that was several years before that actually happened. So they've they're hardly the only place that has done it, but they're one of the few places that has actually been sanctioned for doing something like that.
Finally, I want to ask you, I don't recall hearing this recently, but I know that at one time people used to claim that what we might call the softer drugs, like marijuana, were gateway drugs. And once, you know, you're smoking a joint one day and tomorrow it's crystal meth. Is there any evidence for this?
Well, I mean, there is some truth in that, you know, very few people that have used heroin have not used marijuana. And so that is the, you know, the inkling of truth that people use to, you know, shove the gateway myth down everyone's throats. But no, there's no evidence for that because, look, the vast majority of people that smoke marijuana don't even go on to become regular marijuana users. Most people smoke marijuana, say, you know, that's okay. Not really for me. And so, you know, if you look at the statistics, there's about half the population at this point, and a majority of people under the age of about 50 have smoked marijuana at some point in their lives. The vast majority of those people are not regular marijuana users. The regular marijuana users are about 7-8% of the U.S. population. And that's substantial, but it's also, you know, clearly most people are not going out there and getting hooked on marijuana and then developing a marijuana habit and then moving on to harder things. If you look at the number of people that use harder drugs, so-called harder drugs like cocaine and heroin, you're talking about like 1 or 2 million people, so less than 1% of the population in most studies. That means that, you know, the vast majority of people that use marijuana don't go on to use it regularly, and the vast majority of the people, marijuana users who use it regularly, do not go on to use other substances with any regularity.
John, if people want to follow the work that you're doing at your institute, how can they do that?
They can go to showmecannabis.com. That would probably be the easiest way. Or they can also text SMC for Show Me Cannabis to 420-420.
Wow. Hey, I've never had anybody answer that way before. Wow. Great. All right. Well, way to live in the 21st century, John Payne. I appreciate your time today. This is interesting and important stuff, and I hope that we can have you back on to continue the conversation about topics like this.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. Make sure and check out John Payne and Show Me Cannabis. Before I let you guys go today, this item from Mises.org caught my eye about some features of Obamacare that we were not told about. Well, how about that, right? I'm sure that comes as a big surprise, but that seem pretty relevant. And it basically runs as follows. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that over $1 trillion will be coercively transferred from taxpayers to big insurance companies over the next decade in the form of subsidies and bailouts. And it continues, this massive redistribution of wealth will take place via two programs stealthily embedded in the Affordable Care Act. The first is the reinsurance program under which large claims are capped for insurers offering individual plans under Obamacare. Insurers pay for claims up to $45,000, while the federal government picks up 80% of the costs exceeding $45,000, up to a maximum of $250,000. This means that Obamacare is a public-private insurance scheme and that we are already halfway to the single-payer insurance program that Obama and his left-wing cronies so keenly pine for. Needless to say, neither President Obama nor the establishment media have publicized this provision of Obamacare. Obama and his media supporters have also scrupulously avoided public references to the Risk Corridor program that limits total losses for insurance companies via a complex formula. Basically, under this provision, taxpayers would be on the hook for 75-80% of an insurance company's losses. The enormous taxpayer-funded subsidization of costs and socialization of losses will make Obamacare more palatable to insurance companies and the public, at least for a while, since insurance companies will not need to raise their premiums as much as they would have if they were forced to bear the full burden of cost increases and the risk of huge losses. This may give this destructive program time to take root and wreak havoc with what quality remains in the American healthcare system. Should Obamacare become permanent, Americans as taxpayers and as consumers of medical services will spend many sleepless nights worrying about how they will pay their tax bills and where they will find quality medical care. That's at Mises.org. Some new events to tell you guys about. I've been telling you about my event in Houston this Saturday, January 18th, 2014, with Ron Paul. But also I've got events that I've also told you about, but I've got new ones coming up in just a second. February 7th, Washington College, Chestertown, Maryland. February 8th, Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. But now March 1st, Twin Cities, Idaho. And March 15th in Arkansas at Central Arkansas University with more events to come. So check those out. The details will be up at TomWoods.com, my personal site, TomWoods.com/events. Just this morning, I got an invitation to keynote an event in Albania. I get invitations like this all the time, and it's just very, very hard for me to do international travel. It takes me away from the family, and I've got this huge project I'm working on where I just can't spare a whole lot of time. and there's always a lot of time involved in international travel. So I try to see if I can make them work. I had a trip to Brazil a year or so ago, and I've been to Spain not too long ago, and I went to Chile before that, and I did a lecture tour of Poland, but generally I can't do it. I'd like to try. If it can be done, we'll see if we can do it, but it's just hard for me, and I wish that weren't the case, but I'm afraid it is. Anyway, Ben Swan is joining us here tomorrow. I've been soliciting questions for him on my Facebook page, so join us for that tomorrow. Lots of great guests next week. Help us pay our bills by entering Amazon when you're about to make a purchase through our Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. I have no idea. Those purchases are all anonymous. I have no idea who's doing that for me, but from the bottom of my heart, I say a big thank you to all you guys who are doing it. You're helping us pay our bills and stay going here with the show. Hope you're enjoying the show. See you tomorrow for Ben Swan.
The Tom Woods Show.